Happy Sunday, and thank you for joining me today. So it happened really fast, like super, super fast. The person that did it ran onto the stage, plunging a 33-centimeter samurai sword into his side, and it was done. The attack literally happened in a split second. If you watch the video, which is available on YouTube, it's almost hard to catch at first. You almost have to like play it in slow motion in order for you to actually catch the guy running up onto the stage and plunging this knife into the guy's side. And after being stabbed, he falls to the ground and security tackles the man who did it. It was a 17-year-old who assassinated the Prime Minister of Japan, who was the leader of the Socialist Party, a man named Inigo Osanuma. A news headline that night from British Pathy read this, quote, "Statesman assassinated." This was on October 12, 1960. The following day, the Guardian newspaper did a cover on this story, warning that it could have, quote, far-reaching effects on Japan's relations with the United States, Asia, and the rest of the world. So this is obviously a huge deal. I mean, the Prime Minister of Japan was killed at a political rally by a young citizen who was a member of the extreme right-wing Great Japan Patriotic Society. After that assassination, 15,000 people marched up to the police station headquarters in Tokyo, Japan, demanding the resignation of the police chief, accusing Chief Teramoto of not providing proper security for the Prime Minister. That ultimately became violent as 2,000 police officers viciously pushed them back, leaving 60 students wounded, one of them seriously, and also 22 policemen as well. The assassination of Japanese Prime Minister Inigo Osanuma completely changed the political atmosphere in that country for years. And that type of political carnage, that type of ruthless slaying of a political leader, of a prominent political leader at that, has not happened for more than 60 years in Japan. That is until this week, when the former Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, was shot and killed during a political rally ahead of the parliamentary elections there. Police arrested a 41-year-old suspect, a former military officer. They said he confessed to the crime, but his motive remains unclear. Former Prime Minister Abe was giving a speech for a candidate in Nara, a city located in western Japan, where a man fatally shot him from behind with a homemade gun. Two shots were fired, one hitting Abe in the neck and the other in the abdomen. He was transported to a nearby hospital by helicopter, where he later died. Mr. Abe was only 67 years old. Now, this shooting sent shockwaves across Japan and also across the world. In Japan, this sent shockwaves not only because this was a prominent and influential leader, but also because this type of gun violence in Japan is just super rare. I mean, after the assassination of Japan's prime minister, back in 1960, the political party in control was the Liberal Democratic Party, immediately taking action to prevent something like that from ever happening again, to essentially prevent a national carnage of that magnitude ever taking place again. And on top of that, Japan has some of the strictest gun laws, having completely banned handguns and also rifles. They were also the first nation in the world to impose gun laws. Because of that, shooting deaths are extremely rare. According to NPR, a Japanese citizen told NPR, quote, "Maybe such a thing is normal in the United States, but this took place in Japan and I am shocked. I feel like the clock is going backward," end quote. In terms of gun ownership and gun violence in Japan, the nation ranks among the lowest in the world. Just for context here, according to Japan's National Police Agency, only one person was killed in Japan last year, compared to a record, brace yourself for this, 45,034 gun deaths here in the United States just last year. I mean, we really do have our own major gun violence epidemic here in the United States, and that has taken place for decades. We're going to have special reporting on that coming up here on the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Ian Overton, the executive director of British NGO Action on Armed Violence, wrote in a blog post on Friday that Abe's killing is, quote, almost incomprehensible. This being in a country where the gun deaths rate is literally 0.01%, per 100,000, with an even lower homicide rate. The police have admitted problems in terms of the security as this investigation continues. Abe was born into a political family. his father being a foreign minister and his grandfather and great uncle serving as prime ministers, later emerging onto the political field as an executive assistant to the foreign minister, and then went on to win a seat in the Japanese House of Representatives in 1993. In the early 2000s, he served as the chief cabinet secretary under two administrations. In 2003, he was elected the secretary general of the Liberal Democratic Party. In 2006, he ascended to the office of the prime minister until 2007. It was in 2012 that he was elected to the president of his own party, and he returned as the country's prime minister. He and President Obama together both laid a wreath at the site where the first atomic bomb was dropped by the United States during World War II. The former prime minister was also known for his big economic initiatives, namely recognized as Abenomics. If you recall, under the Trump administration, a lot of weird things happened during that presidency, but perhaps among the weirdest of things were Trump's handshakes. There was a viral moment online where Trump shook Abe's hand for 19 seconds straight, and he finally gets free from this and is like, woo! I mean, if you watch the video, his facial expression is priceless. But his second term as the prime minister lasted from 2012 to 2020, just 8 years, when he resigned due to health issues. His final years in office were met with scandals and accusation that he mishandled the nation's COVID crisis. Mr. Abe's body returned to Tokyo yesterday. Now, I mentioned at the top of the show that he was giving a speech for a political candidate ahead of the parliamentary elections in that country. He was assassinated while giving that speech, and that undoubtedly was on voters' minds as they went to vote. Well, we can now report that today, in an unambiguous and concise display of his legacy, Shinzo Abe's allies won a supermajority in Japan's parliament, giving them a new chance to pursue amending the country's constitution. The New York Times writes, quote, "The election results were a clear sign that Mr. Abe, Japan's longest-serving prime minister, remained a guiding political force," end quote. In terms of geopolitics right now and what's happening in terms of beyond our shores, this has been a busy, busy news week. I mean, just in the past 72 hours, the former prime minister of Japan was assassinated, the UK prime minister Boris Johnson resigned, and then 59 other British politicians resigned en masse. The official residences of the president and prime minister of Sri Lanka were stormed by protesters amid the nation's economic crisis that led to the resignation of their prime minister, which actually had his house burned down. The president is expected to resign next week. When his home was stormed, he was not there because he had already been moved to a secure, undisclosed location. Let's just start with that second story there in Sri Lanka. This was reporting from Nine News Australia.
In an extraordinary 24 hours in Sri Lanka, surging crowds taking over the presidential palace, forcing both the president and the prime minister to resign. It's the culmination of months of widespread anger. The country suffering through its worst economic crisis in 70 years, with food, fuel and electricity running out.
Revolution on the streets of Colombo. Flashpoint of an economic crisis, breaking into the country's central bank and storming the presidential palace. Security forces tried to beat them back, but were no match for the heaving crowd on a mission to force President Gotabaya Rajapaksa out. He was seen boarding a boat and fleeing with his family as rioters overran his home, cramming into bedrooms for selfies.
Mr. President, thank you. I'm sleeping in your bed.
Chanting in stairwells and corridors. Even washing themselves in the pool. The fleet of luxury vehicles, a cruel juxtaposition in a bankrupt country where food and medicine is scarce.
The air conditions are running in that presidential palace while people don't have electricity in their homes.
After storming the presidential palace, protesters broke into the prime minister's home and set it alight. People blame the president and his family for economic mismanagement, which has left millions struggling to eat. Foreign exchange reserves have hit record lows, which means the government doesn't have the cash to pay for essential imports, Fuel is running out and the inflation rate of food is up more than 80%, exacerbated by COVID and the war in Ukraine. For months, Sri Lankans have been forced to queue for hours for bare basics, including this bus driver. I work one day and stand in queues for 5 days. Because of that, we want to get rid of them. In the wake of the unrest, President Rajapaksa announced he will resign next week, the Prime Minister agreeing to step down too. Sri Lanka's government is relying on a bailout from the International Monetary Fund, but talks are complicated given the nation is already bankrupt. Sophie Walsh, Nine News.
This is reporting from the New York Times on the emerging crisis in Sri Lanka. Quote, Sri Lanka needs billions of dollars as it exhausts its source of financing. Quote, Sri Lanka needs $6 billion through the end of the year to buy fuel and other essential goods to stabilize its crumbling economy. The question is where that money will come from. One of its most steadfast patrons, India, has already provided $4 billion in credit and loans, which Sri Lanka has burned through in recent months. In meetings held in Colombo, Indian officials have expressed willingness to keep supporting the country, but it's unclear just how much more India will do. The situation has grown so desperate that Sri Lanka has asked President Vladimir Putin of Russia for a credit line to buy fuel. Government delegations were even dispatched abroad to meet with anyone who might be able to help, including charities in Qatar. China, a longtime ally of the ruling Rajapaksa family, has largely kept a distance. In the past years, China has bankrolled many of their major infrastructure projects with loans. Sri Lanka's monthly fuel bill alone amounts to about, you ready for this? $500 million. Officials have said that many of its traditional fuel suppliers are reluctant to sell to the country as the state of the oil company is mired in debt and it's struggling to pay off. In recent months, some suppliers have refused to unload fuel tanks docked at Sri Lankan ports until payment was made. Fuel shipments from India occasionally ease the long lines at Sri Lanka gas stations, but when suppliers dwindle, the government has rationed fuel and try to repress demand by ordering state employees to work from home, for example. The cooking gas shortage became so hopeless for a while that people stopped shopping for it, in some cases leaving their empty cylinders in the street, chaining them together to prevent theft. It was just recently that as Sri Lankans were protesting this massive economic crisis in their country, even struggling to get gas and just air conditioning in their own homes. I mean, amid that crisis, security forces in Sri Lanka were ordered to shoot and kill on site. Actual protesters. They were ordered to shoot and kill. Essentially that just reigniting, I mean, what essentially was a brutal, brutal, absolutely despondent, horrific, diabolical civil war that transpired in that country from 1983 to 2009, lasting 26 years. 26 years in that country that civil war lasted. Essentially, the roots of that major catastrophe essentially go back to the point where British colonization in terms of how it began. By 1977, clashes were already breaking out between the Tamil youth and also the police officers. Anti-Tamil riots also erupted across the country, causing several hundred deaths. Immediately after the young people in that nation became radicalized, moving, they later began to take aim at Sri Lanka Army, at the Sri Lankan Army. By 1983, 13 soldiers were killed in an ambush and retaliation. Organized massacres against the Tamil population killed several thousand people. That would be the start of this civil war. That lasted until 2009. This massacre lasted until 2009. According to France24.com, in reality, until all the Tamil Tiger guerrillas had been killed, quote, at least 100,000 people lost their lives, tens of thousands went missing, and hundreds of thousands were displaced, with most of the civilian victims being the Tamils. Some 13 years later, reconciliation appears far off. The current Sri Lankan president is considered a hero by the Sinhalese, but is accused of war crimes by the Tamils from his time as defense secretary. In the former war zone in the northeast, tens of thousands of women have lost their husbands in the conflict, many confirmed dead, many others still missing. For them, mourning is impossible as they fight for the truth about what happened. End quote. This was as recent as just this year. End quote. That's reporting from France24.com. We will keep an eye on that story amid the growing political and economic calamity in that nation. It was just earlier this week that the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced his resignation. Building his career on lies, starting off as a journalist, he was first elected to British Parliament back in 2001. 2 years later, on national television in 2003, he made essentially a joke about him being potentially the Prime Minister one day, essentially comparing that to the chances of me, Boris Johnson, becoming the Prime Minister is like the odds of somebody getting decapitated with a, I feel like somebody getting decapitated with a Frisbee. That's what he said. That's what he said on live television, essentially making this a huge joke that, haha, me ever being Prime Minister? Really? Nice one, guys. In 2012, Boris Johnson became the mayor of London, where during an Olympic event, he hilariously got stuck on a zip line. 4 years later, he campaigned during the Brexit referendum, which basically was a vote on if the UK should leave the European Union or not. They ultimately did, turning the country more right, dividing the nation. Over the course of his tenure as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, he drew multiple Trumpian comparisons until his inevitably tumultuous demise, from a plethora of scandals, including illegally suspending Parliament to quickly finish his own Brexit deal, hosting and throwing parties during the COVID-19 lockdowns, endorsing and supporting a lawmaker he knew had a history of sexual misconduct, but saying that, oops, I forgot, attempting to get his girlfriend a job. I mean, do you want me to go on? That's not even just half of it. But he survived all of those scandals until he couldn't anymore. The 59 British politicians that resigned en masse earlier this week were from Boris Johnson's party. They resigned en masse in order to force him out of office. It was a historically gargantuan protest resignation. Oh, also did I mention that Brittany Griner, a famous WNBA player arrested in Russia a couple months ago on bogus charges, pleaded guilty in Russia. In a Russian court just this week, where 1% are acquitted, 0.1% really, essentially known as Putin's court. So that is just geopolitics. That's just what's happening around the world. I mean, and I bet that's only half of it as well. Here at home in the United States, a lot happened this week as well. We've got more coming up tonight on the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Stay with us. It's a very, very busy night.
I love my new home. I always wanted a house with historic architecture, but it might be too Victorian.
Hey, gosh, interesting hemline on those pants.
Yes, I do believe they're called pants.
Pardon me.
No, pardon me. At least Geico makes bundling my home and car insurance easy. I save so much.
I have come to call upon...
Just text me. While I'm heading up.
It's a ghost.
For bundling made easy, go to geico.com.
It's called self-care.
When Richard Nixon was sworn in as president in 1969, he nominated a Republican attorney from Georgia to be the new IRS commissioner. Now, this person did not work for the Nixon campaign in 1968. He was not politically active as a Republican back home in Georgia, but he was well-liked and recommended. This was his first time meeting the newly elected president of the United States. He said that he saw Nixon as this perspicacious politician and that he hoped to bring a new progressive approach to federal tax policy. Now, during his time on the job, he dealt with the White House trying to install many people at the IRS. He later said that one who alarmed him the most was G. Gordon Liddy, a former FBI agent who's later caught and arrested for breaking into the DNC leading up to the Watergate scandal. Mr. Thrower described him as a, quote, gun nut. He was chosen to be the head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which was then a branch under the IRS. But having the head of the agency thinking you're a gun nut probably isn't going to get you the job. So ultimately, Mr. Liddy did not receive that job. After just a couple of years working as the IRS commissioner, Randolph Thrower came across something very disturbing. So he decided that he needed to speak directly with the president, one-on-one. And so he contacted the White House and requested a personal meeting with President Richard Nixon. The New York Times writes, quote, in January 1971, after Mr. Thrower requested a meeting with the president, hoping to warn him personally about the pressure White House staff members have been placing on the IRS to audit the tax returns of certain individuals, beginning with anti-war leaders and civil rights figures, the list had grown to include journalists and members of Congress, among them every Democratic senator up for re-election in 1970. End quote. Now, without jumping to judgment here, Commissioner Thrower was quite certain that President Richard Nixon was definitely unaware of this kind of political pressure on a nonpartisan institution like the IRS. He said that the president would certainly agree with me that any suggestion of the introduction of political influence into the IRS was wrong and could damage Nixon's presidency. Right? Surely he would agree. No, that was not the case, because Richard Nixon was not as concerned as he was about the political influence on the IRS about White House staff by White House staffers. But still, without knowing that, he calls up the White House to see if he could arrange a personal meeting with POTUS, and he receives two responses. The first was from the president's appointment secretary saying that a meeting would not be possible, and the second was a phone call from the White House domestic policy advisor, which was John Ehrlichman, telling him that he was fired. And so it turned out that White House officials putting political pressure on the IRS was not astonishing to Nixon. When Nixon realized that Randolph Thrower was going to be a problem on capitulating to that type of political pressure, he was like, no, we'll just have to find another guy. One of the top contenders for the IRS commissioner was a guy named John Nolan. He was in charge of tax policy at the Treasury Department. He had been recommended by Nixon's Treasury Secretary, John Connally. But President Richard Nixon really knew what he wanted to use the Internal Revenue Service for, and he was willing to be very direct and explicit about that. So his staff tells him that Nolan is a great guy, and we know he's been recommended by John Connally, the Secretary of Treasury, but he's probably not going to do what you want him to do. He's probably not going to do what you want. The only reason we know that is because this conversation transpired on tape. It was recorded. In a revelatory, damning, explicit tape recording, Nixon, one of his staffers, tells him this, quote, I'm assured that Nolan will not play that game, end quote, referring to like the political pressure there. This is a White House staffer telling Nixon, hey, he's probably not going to do what you want. And this is just a remarkable exchange. I mean, quote, I want to be sure he's a ruthless son of a, that he'll do what he's told, that he'll go after our enemies and not go after our friends. It's as simple as that. We've got to have somebody like that for a change in this place. End quote. After that exchange with Nixon and his staff, he turns down this recommendation from his Secretary of Treasury. He turns down this recommendation from John Connally. Nevertheless, Nolan doesn't get the job, but they keep looking. And they found someone else who works at the Justice Department under the leadership of Nixon's former campaign manager, John Mitchell. Being that Nixon knew Mitchell well and used him for a lot of corrupt purposes, he thought for sure that this guy would be the one. This guy is for sure going to do what I want. He would be a ruthless son of a... He would go after our political enemies and he would not go after our friends. And so he gets this job as IRS commissioner. His name is Johnny Walters, a Republican from South Carolina who oversaw the tax division at DOJ. And of course, Nixon expects that he'll be able to start using the IRS as a political weapon, just wielding it at that he alone controls. So on September 11th, 1972, White House counsel John Dean calls IRS Commissioner Johnny Walters. He calls up this new IRS commissioner that Nixon has just installed there for a one-on-one meeting. They meet in his office and Dean hands him a list of hundreds of people who the White House wants investigated by the IRS. Instead of saying, okay, yes, sir, Walters says he was shocked. He said that if he complied with that order by the president, quote, it'd make Watergate look like a Sunday school picnic, end quote. At this point, we are in September of 1972. Watergate had transpired that summer in June. Remember, this is 2 months before Nixon's re-election. And among the people on that list were staffers and donors to Democratic Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern. So still in astonishment, IRS Commissioner Johnny Walters goes back to the Department of Treasury, where the IRS is, and tells Secretary George Shultz about this. At this point, Johnny Walters still had the envelope sealed and all. And what does he do with it? He puts it back in a safe and he locks it up. Then, by the summer of 1973 in June, after John Dean had been forced out of the White House in April, he flips on Nixon and the existence of the Watergate enemies list becomes known.
Whether it be an FBI investigation of an individual or an IRS audit, do you consider that to be legal and proper activities by those security arms?
As I say, I don't know of the IEC itself preparing political material. I do, of course, know, and as I have submitted in documents, other agencies were involved in seeking politically embarrassing information on individuals who were thought to be enemies of the White House. I might also add that in my possession is a rather, very much down the lines of what you're talking about, is a memorandum that was requested by me to prepare a means to attack the enemies of the White House. There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
I'm not going to ask who was on it. I'm afraid you might answer. I wonder, are these documents that are in the possession of the committee?
No, but I'd be happy to submit them to the committee. They didn't fit within the request that I had with counsel as to the documents he wished to have produced, but if the committee does wish them, I'll be happy to submit them.
Mr. Chairman, I think the committee would like very much to have a copy of that memorandum.
All right, sir.
You could hear the laughter and essentially the shock in the room as John Dean reveals this previously unknown list on national television. After Dean says this, the IRS commissioner, Johnny Walters, went into his safe in his office, unlocked it, and took that list out, and he handed it over to Congress. He handed it over to the Watergate Senate Committee. It was sealed, still sealed. He had never opened it. And looking back on that enemies list now, you realize that it was a campaign to push anyone who is an outspoken critic of President Richard Nixon or someone prominent enough that the president deemed as a political or social threat. Anyone who had the courage to stand up to Nixon and be fierce about it was added to that list. You could hear former White House counsel John Dean say the list was being continually updated. It was a persistent effort by the president to go after his enemies, even ordering government agencies to do so.
While the bulk of the Senate session today dealt with challenges to Dean's story, there was one other area which Dean opened up. He turned over to the committee documents he had saved, which show, if they're not elaborate forgeries, that the White House was planning to use the Internal Revenue Service and other federal agencies as weapons against political opponents, who are called enemies on some documents. This is an example of that file, a memo drafted for Haldeman and Ehrlichman by Dean himself. It describes a plan, in Dean's own pungent language, to use the available federal machinery to screw our political enemies.
Quote, use the available federal machinery to screw our political enemies. Don't just make a list with their names on it, but we will also use and order the federal government to inflict pain on them. This was a relentless campaign by the President of the United States and his administration to undermine and sabotage his political enemies. That was during the Nixon administration. Earlier this week, the New York Times dropped a bombshell reporting, that two former FBI officials were actually randomly audited. They were randomly selected for a rare tax audit by the IRS under the Trump administration. This is reporting from CNBC News.
Two top FBI officials who President Trump fired face rare and rigorous audits on taxes they filed while he was in office. The former FBI director, James Comey, his deputy, Andrew McCabe, turned over IRS letters to the New York Times. Now, the head of the agency is asking the inspector general to review those IRS audits. The odds of the IRS selecting somebody for that type of audit are slim. One in 30,000. You are more likely to get struck by lightning. So the odds of two people within a close circle? Very rare. But a spokesperson for the IRS released a statement today saying it's ludicrous and untrue to suggest that senior IRS officials somehow targeted specific individuals for National Research Program audits. Well, we'll see. Comey and McCabe told the New York Times neither knew that the other was facing an audit until the Times reporter told them. Comey told the Times, maybe it's a coincidence, or maybe somebody misused the IRS to get at a political enemy. Given the role Trump wants to continue to play in our country, we should know that answer to that question. Here's CNBC's Shamari Stone.
Former FBI Director James Comey and former FBI Acting Director Andrew McCabe, both frequent targets of former President Trump, were long subjects to repeated attacks over their involvement in the Russia probe.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil.
Trump also publicly called for them to be prosecuted.
Who specifically are you accusing of treason?
Well, I think a number of people. If you look at Comey, if you look at McCabe.
And fired Comey just 4 months after taking office.
I fired Comey. Well, I turned out to do the right thing.
The firing led to the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller and an investigation into possible links between the Trump campaign and Russia. It also led to McCabe's taking over the FBI in 2017. He, too, was fired just one day before he was set to retire. In the letters provided to the New York Times, Comey and McCabe revealed they both faced an audit for the 2017 and 2019 returns, respectively. At the time both audits occurred, the IRS was run by a Trump appointee.
This is the latest in what's been a long saga of being targeted by the former administration.
A former IRS commissioner telling us the audits are unusual.
It's rare in the sense of you have two people in, well, the same position with a year or two being in this generalized audit review. You would think, well, that's an odd circumstance.
The IRS defending its protocols in a statement saying the institution has strong safeguards in place to protect the exam process and against politically motivated audits. The IRS, no stranger to political scandals, the Nixon White House was accused of pressuring the then IRS commissioner.
Well, I'm not a crook.
To target his enemies with tax audits during the time of the Watergate scandal.
One of the ways he abused presidential power was to tell the Internal Revenue Service, I want you to do big, intrusive, bruising audits on certain of my political enemies.
Now, a Trump spokesman told the New York Times that the former president had no knowledge of those audits. The IRS has referred the matter to the Treasury Inspector General for a tax administration for review. Shep?
Shamari Stone, live in D.C.
Once again, that's reporting from CNBC News here. I mean, this is just an extraordinary political tale here of how Nixon used the IRS to get at his political enemies. The question, I guess, remains now is, did Donald Trump do the same thing? This comes as the former president is facing lots of criminal culpability in terms of what is a huge, huge emerging investigation on Capitol Hill, the January 6th committee, having major news developments. And we got that story next.
This is how we do it.
Turns out Montel Jordan knows how to do almost everything. And it turns out the General is a quality insurance company that's been saving people money for nearly 60 years. For a great low rate and nearly 60 years of quality coverage, go with the General.
In April, former White House counsel Pat Cipollone testified before the January 6th committee in a closed-door deposition, and essentially in that agreement to the committee, Cipollone could not discuss conversations that he had with Trump or that others had about Trump, so he could not talk about that, but the January 6th committee now has him again, and he has agreed to testify essentially as his name has been repeatedly and continuously invoked amid recently just the bombshell Cassidy Hutchinson testimony. Of course, the January 6th committee is set to reconvene for the next live congressional hearing this Tuesday on July 12th, where former Trump Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews will testify. We do not know if it will be as explosive as Ms. Hutchinson's, but of course, we never underestimate when it comes to this committee. In terms of what the committee has next and the people who can testify next, this was just breaking news. Steve Bannon will now be among potential future witnesses. This is reporting from NBC News.
Possible cooperation from an unlikely source. An about-face from top Trump ally Steve Bannon after former President Trump greenlighted his cooperation with the January 6th committee. waiving executive privilege over Bannon's testimony, though it was unclear those protections applied anyway. Bannon now saying he's open to testifying. He is set to stand trial for contempt of Congress within weeks over his previously steadfast refusal to cooperate with the committee.
MAGA is on the march. The J6 committee is totally irrelevant.
His lawyer saying he prefers to testify live, though committee members say that's unlikely. But it's a pattern of new cooperation. Trump's former top White House lawyer, Pat Cipollone, was deposed for nearly 8 hours Friday.
He was able to provide information, including the president's what I would call dereliction of duty on the day of January 6th.
Cipollone present for key moments in those final weeks of the Trump era.
Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable.
Committee members saying he didn't contradict any previous witnesses' testimony. All this sure to play out in the committee's home stretch this week, with two hearings expected on the Hill. Tuesday is set to focus on how the mob came together, spotlighting right-wing extremist groups, including testimony from a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers, and drawing a line between these groups, the former president, and his top allies, even as new footage, subpoenaed by the committee, shows Trump downplaying the 6th.
They were angry from the standpoint of what happened in the election, because they're smart, and they see, and they saw what happened.
And Ali Vitale is with me now. What's the end game here for these hearings, Ali?
The committee will release a public report sometime this fall, Kate, and the door's open for criminal referrals as well. But the decision to prosecute ultimately rests with the Department of Justice. Kate?
Once again, that's reporting from NBC News. So as you heard her say there, the committee will hold a hearing on Tuesday. That's Tuesday, July 12th, this Tuesday. Their second hearing comes on Thursday in a primetime hearing before the nation. This is reporting from the Los Angeles Times, quote, the House committee investigating the January 6th riot is returning to primetime with a Thursday evening hearing that will examine the three-hour-plus stretch when then-President Trump failed to act as mob of supporters stormed the Capitol. The committee is racing to gather newly emerging evidence, and the session could be the final one in a series of public hearings that began in early June. A lawyer for former President Trump, strategist Steve Bannon, who faces criminal charges after months of defying a congressional subpoena, told the committee over the weekend that Bannon may now be willing to testify, according to committee members. Quote, I expect that we will be hearing from him, and there are many questions that we have for him, Representative Zoe Lofgren says. She and other committee members said that they wanted to hear from Bannon in a deposition with sworn testimony. Thursday's hearing will be the first time will be the first in a prime time slot since the June 9th debut that was viewed by 20 million people. A hearing Tuesday will focus on the plotting and planning of the insurrection on January 6, 2021 by white nationalist groups such as the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and also the Three Percenters, end quote. Another one of the big questions, as you heard at the end of that NBC News clip here, is essentially the prosecutions here. Will we see prosecutions for the January 6th rolls? That is something that we are following closely live here. Politico recently reported on the updates, essentially, of where the January 6th prosecutions stand just 18 months after the attack. Quote, 18 months since a pro-Trump mob ransacked the Capitol and disrupted the peaceful transition of presidential power, prosecutors are closing in on another milestone, 900 arrests. According to the latest Justice Department figures, more than 855 members of the crowd, are facing charges that range from trespassing on restricted grounds to seditious conspiracy. Prosecutors estimate that more than 2,000 people actually enter the Capitol unlawfully that day, which means hundreds more arrests are likely to come in the following months. For a year and a half, the justice system has been slowly grinding through those cases, which have been taken on increasing complexity as the House January 6th Select Committee reveals new details about then-President Donald Trump's own role in fomenting the events of that day, end quote. We're going to have more reporting on that this week as the January 6th committee announces these new hearings and testimony presumably comes through with just explosive revelations. Whew. We got a lot more to get to tonight. Actually, I think one more segment here on the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
whether you put down your phone to be there for your daughter, or pick up your phone to call a helpline for your roommate, when it comes to mental health, now more than ever, every action counts.
Welcome back. On tomorrow on the Jeremiah Patterson Show, prepare for another blockbuster episode in terms of lots of breaking news stories. I'm sorry for the repeated disruption of our usual normal schedule, which is new episodes every Saturday and Sunday. But of course, there was a lot happening in the news, lots of scrambling, lots of throwing out shows and making new ones. But we are back on track, of course. Also, one more thing, the anniversary of the show is just 9 days away. That is the 4-year anniversary of TJPS Productions. Absolutely fantastic. I remember it was just yesterday that I was sitting on my bed in Mimi's house actually recording a podcast episode. I was talking about this Trump-Putin Time Magazine comparison. But yeah, that's on the way. That's coming up. So make sure to get in your audio messages. You can send it in through Anchor, of course, or you can like send in an email to jdpat775@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening to this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Have a great day. Remember to stay positive and inspired. Whew, and I'll see you tomorrow.